What's my subscription to the New York Times have me doing this week? Preparing a strawberry pretzel pie. Solving spelling bee with no hints. Planning a trip to one of the 52 best places to go. Getting to the bottom of the big pants trend.
Whoa.
And I'm finally replacing my vacuum with a recommendation I can trust. What will your subscription to the Times have you do? Why not find out? With our best offer, go to nytimes.com/subscribe.
From the New York Times, I'm Michael Barbaro. This is The Daily. Today, the city of Charlottesville, Virginia, is transformed into a battleground in one of the bloodiest fights yet over the removal of Confederate monuments across the South. And the president condemns the violence, quote, on all sides, but does not take special aim at the white nationalists. It's Monday, August 14th. Cheryl Gay Stolberg, you were there in Charlottesville this weekend as all these events unfolded. Start us at the beginning. What was supposed to be happening this weekend?
Well, what was supposed to be happening was a noon rally, a so-called Unite the Right rally, hosted by white nationalists at Emancipation Park, formerly called Lee Park. Emancipation Park has a statue of General Robert E. Lee in the middle of it, statue of him riding a horse. The city wants to remove the statue, and white nationalists are protesting the removal.
So what actually happens this weekend? Start us, Cheryl, with Friday night.
So Friday night, after dark, a band of these white nationalists came onto the University of Virginia campus carrying torches, and they were chanting, "You will not replace us. Jews will not replace us." This is just such an intimidating moment, Michael. I mean, the torch at night in here in the South just evokes memories of the KKK. And there was a scuffle there. There were some arrests. A police officer was injured.
White lives matter! White lives matter! White lives
And that was kind of the precursor to the events of Saturday. So let's talk about Saturday. There was, at 6 a.m., a sunrise service at the First Baptist Church here, a historically black church, where faith leaders and people who wanted to come out and demonstrate against these alt-right protesters gathered.
How sweet it is to be in the struggle for justice.
They heard from Dr. Cornel West, Harvard Divinity professor and political activist, who told me he was coming to bear witness to the face of white supremacy.
Still got sick white brothers and sisters, neo-Nazi,
and then across town at around 9 o'clock in the morning, the alt-right white nationalists, neo-Nazi, white supremacists were gathering in a different park, a park called McIntyre Park.
Okay.
Now, their rally was not supposed to start until noon, but they were pulled up in their cars and their trucks with their flags, and some carrying shields, some wearing helmets, you know, just getting ready for battle.
You see what I'm talking about. Look at these burly, strong, proud white boys.
And they were going to head downtown to Emancipation Park. Now, mind you, their rally was not supposed to start until noon, but everything was getting going a lot earlier than expected. So you had on the one end of the city, the people at church, which consisted of a lot of members of the clergy, about 30, and others. They had trained in the tactics of nonviolent protest. They were prepared to be arrested or to get involved in violence. They were marching to Emancipation Park. And so what you had was these two groups converging on this park where the statue was.
And clearly to confront each other.
Clearly. Now, the whole park was surrounded with police barricades and police tape. And inside the barricades was a line of Virginia State Police and Charlottesville Police. And what wound up happening was the alt-right people were funneling their way into the park, the counter-protesters, including some dressed in black with helmets and shields, the so-called Antifa, the anti-fascists, mm-hmm. were on the outside of the park in the street, on a street called Market Street. And so you started to have little skirmishes.
It's over! You're a fucking rally! You are a fucking whore!
I've been given an ultimatum.
I was outside the park on Market Street watching as these white supremacists tried to make their way into the park, and the counter-demonstrators, including the clergy, were trying to block them. The clergy also linked arms outside the park, linking arms and singing spirituals, singing... You know, this little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. Just praying and trying to be peaceful, but also trying at certain points to block the entry of the white nationalists.
Hail Trump! Hail Trump!
And the skirmishes kept getting worse and more intense. It really felt like the violence was escalating as more and more of these white nationalists kept arriving and people were trying to block them. Suddenly clubs were coming out. And pepper spray was being sprayed, and there were smoke bombs being thrown, and both sides had bats and were beating each other, and they were holding up their shields, and, you know, it was truly a melee. And at about 11:22, in fact, at precisely 11:22, the governor declared a state of emergency.
Virginia's Governor Terry McAuliffe declaring a state of emergency. The crowd ordered to disperse.
You're gonna leave the area now, or you will be arrested.
Someone asked, how in the world did we get here? That is a good question.
Cheryl, who were these white nationalist protesters, and where did they come from?
You know, frankly, Michael, it was really hard to find out exactly who they were. A lot of them wouldn't give me their last names. Mm. One of them gave his name as, I think, Ted from Missouri, and I said, why won't you give me your last name? And he said, I might want to run for public office one day. And he told me, I'm tired of seeing white people pushed around. But it's clear that they were coming mostly from out of town and some from in town. And interestingly, Michael, a lot of young millennial men, not surprising that they were men, but the age was surprising to me. So many young people.
When you say young people, you're talking what, like 20?
20s-ish, 30-ish, you know, not middle-aged, but on the younger side. So after the crowd dispersed, you know, it was in the downtown area, and there was a downtown pedestrian mall right nearby, and, you know, there were still lots and lots of protesters, thousands of people wandering around downtown, and all of a sudden, seemingly out of nowhere, this gray Dodge Charger starts zooming into the crowd, and people are screaming, and bodies were flying up in the air. Then he backed up and sort of rammed another car and sort of, I was told by eyewitnesses, backed his way out of the street. There was blood everywhere and glass everywhere, and it was just a horrific, horrific scene. And as we know, a 32-year-old woman, Heather Heyer, who was among the counter-protesters, was killed by that car. And that driver, a man from Ohio, 20-year-old from Ohio, is facing murder charges now.
And what do we know about the man who drove into the protesters?
Well, we know a few things about him. We know that he had told his mother that he was coming to Virginia, and I believe she told the local newspaper, the Toledo Blade, that she thought it was somehow related to President Trump.
At 4:54 Saturday afternoon, Virginia State Police were notified of a helicopter crash in Albemarle County.
And as if the events of Saturday weren't tragic enough, at the end of the day,
they located the wreckage of a helicopter.
A Virginia State Police helicopter crashed, killing two of the troopers inside. So a tragic, tragic end to a very, very difficult day.
And they were responding to this.
They were monitoring the situation. They were part of the police response.
So in the end, we have three deaths here.
Yes, that's right. Three deaths.
Cheryl, tell us about the role of the police in all this.
Well, The role of the police is a matter of some question here, Michael. I'm trying to sort that out. Mm-hmm. I talked to Governor Terry McAuliffe, and also I talked to his Secretary for Public Safety, and they both maintain that the police did exactly as they should have, and they both mentioned that this was a heavily armed crowd. And I should have mentioned this to you, Michael. Mm-hmm. Along with the line of clergy, there was a line of self-styled militia men carrying assault rifles.
Wow.
And wearing camouflage. And they looked like, I thought they were the National Guard at first. I kept saying, are you the National Guard? Like, who are you?
Who are they?
And then I could see some of them had patches that said, like, New York Militia. And they would say, well, ma'am, we're just here to keep the peace. We're neutral. But nonetheless, it looked like an invading army. So with all these guns, you know, Virginia is an open carry state, and with all this violence, both Terry McAuliffe and Brian Moran, the public safety secretary, told me that they felt it went extremely well, that you could not predict that this car would crash into a crowd and kill a woman, that that could not have been predicted or averted. But I think we're going to be having questions about how the police handled this for a long time to come.
It sounds like what you're saying, Cheryl, is that with so many armed people on the ground there, that the authorities, law enforcement, is saying that things went pretty well from their perspective, reasonably.
That is what they're saying. Terry McAuliffe told me that the militias had better weapons than his own state police.
And clearly, from what you're describing, white nationalists, rightfully or not, are feeling emboldened. I was quite struck by the fact that these protesters did not wear masks. They weren't hooded. Maybe they weren't using their last names and giving them to the New York Times, but we're seeing them being identified now on social media because.
Absolutely.
So are you sensing that they are emboldened?
I am sensing that white nationalists are emboldened. And while some of them are not using their names, plenty of others are. Like, you know, Richard Spencer, who is a prominent white nationalist, put out a message.
And if you think that we're going to back down to this kind of behavior by you in your little provincial town, you think we're going to back down? No. We are going to make Charlottesville the center of the universe. We are going to come back here often. Your head's going to spin. How many times we're going to be back here? We are absolutely never backing down.
You saw what David Duke said. You know, he basically told the president that he needed to look in the mirror because these were the people who elected him.
Mm-hmm. We're going to fulfill the promises of Donald Trump. That's what we believed in. That's why we voted for Donald Trump, because he said he's going to take our country back. And that's what we got to do.
This Jason Kessler, who, by the way, Michael, Jason Kessler tried to have a press conference here today.
Mm-hmm. Her name was Heather, sir. Her name was Heather, Jason. Her blood is on your hands. Her blood is on your hood.
And somebody sucker punched him and he had to leave.
I think I just watched that video. I mean, it seemed like he was literally chased out of town.
Yeah. Run out of town. And that's what McAuliffe wants. He said, go home. Don't come here. Get out.
You are not wanted in this great commonwealth. Shame on you. You pretend that you're patriots, but you are anything but a patriot.
Cheryl, I want to thank you very much.
Thanks, Michael, as always.
We'll be right back.
My name is Jasmine Ulloa, and I'm a national politics reporter for The New York Times. I grew up in Texas, on the border with Mexico, and I've been reporting in the region since I was in high school. Now I travel the country looking for stories and voices that really capture what immigration and the nation's demographic changes mean for people. What I keep encountering is that voters don't fall into neat ideological boxes on this very volatile issue. There's a lot of gray, and that's where I feel the most interesting stories are. I'm trying to bring that complexity and nuance to our audience, especially in such a critical election year. And that's really what all of my colleagues on the politics team and every journalist at the New York Times is aiming to do. Our mission is to help you understand the world, no matter how complicated it might be. If you want to support this mission, consider subscribing to The New York Times. You can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Glenn Thrush.
Hey, it's Michael.
Hey, how's it going?
Hey, how are you? Where are you?
I am in Bedminster.
You are? So you're with the president?
Yeah, I'm sitting right now in the press filing area in a Marriott hotel in Bridgewater, New Jersey, which is just a couple of miles up the road from the president's golf resort in Bedminster.
Okay, so thank you for making some time. Glenn, what was the president's initial response to what happened in Charlottesville?
Well, his initial response was to delay a Veterans Affairs announcement at his golf club by about a half an hour to kind of discuss what it is he was going to say.
Mm-hmm.
And then he sort of distilled all of that and, as is his wont, sort of came out and said what he wanted to say.
We condemn in the strongest possible terms this egregious display of hatred, bigotry, and violence on many sides. On many sides.
On many sides.
Many sides.
Doubled up on that.
It's been going on for a long time in our country. Not Donald Trump, not Barack Obama. This has been going on for a long, long time.
So you can see it is a Trumpian hybrid of talking points that were given to him and his own emphasis on this.
What is vital now is a swift restoration of law and order and the protection of innocent lives.
This was not sort of your standard presidential healing the nation's wounds kind of speech. It was highly politicized and very equivocal.
I mean, Glenn, the phrase that has attracted a lot of attention and that is most intriguing, I think, to both of us is this phrase, many sides. And you have been reporting on kind of what the story is behind that line. What do you think it is?
If you look at his pattern of behavior rather than what he said, and this is what's interesting on this, Michael, this is a guy who is defined by the volume and the bombast of his language. It's very, very hard to mistake what Donald Trump intends because he says it,
right?
This is one of those instances where it's the quiet spaces.
So what you're saying is this is a president who knows how to condemn and does condemn. And we've talked to you about this so many times. He certainly knows how to condemn his own attorney general. He knows how to condemn the news media. He knows how to condemn the former president of the United States, Barack Obama. You're saying that because he chooses not to condemn white nationalists, that by omission, there's something meaningful there.
Yeah, in the same harsh terms that he condemns Islamic terrorism. And yet he himself has been loath to kind of go down this road. And, you know, there are things that this president, who is so known for being talkative, doesn't want to talk about.
So the president got a lot of pushback on both sides, Republican and Democratic, for this initial statement. What can you tell us about the response to the statement?
So kind of one by one in the last 24 hours, and I haven't checked all the Twitter feeds, but I suspect a majority, if not all, members of the Senate have weighed in on this. You had Chuck Grassley of Iowa. You had Ben Sasse of Nebraska, who a frequent Trump critic, come out early on this. I think really most forcefully, you had kind of a semi-moderate Republican from Colorado, Cory Gardner, go on the Sunday shows and really explicitly call the president out for not addressing this more directly.
This president has done an incredible job of naming terrorism around the globe as evil, radical Islamic terrorism, whether it's in Europe or the Middle East. He has said and called it out time and time again, and this president needs to do exactly that today. Call this white supremacism, this white nationalism, evil, and let the country hear it, let the world hear it. It's something that needs to come from the Oval Office, and this White House needs to do it today.
I guess it's worth noting that you're talking about, these are all Republicans who are criticizing the Republican president over this, which is just somewhat unusual.
It's unusual, but this is really the way this is evolving, Michael. This is a benchmark moment for this president. Really, in a parallel to what's going on in North Korea, things are getting really, really serious, and his standard operating mode is really coming into question. You know, most of the time when the president says or does something, people get angry or outraged. But I think his response this time, and I've talked to probably 30 or 40 politicians in both parties over the course of the last 36 hours, there's a real sense that this was an opportunity that was squandered, that the president had a chance to ennoble, to elevate, to empathize with people, and to really move beyond a lot of the acrimony that's bogged down the White House. And he didn't do that. And I think people are feeling
sad.
I have no other way to put it, just kind of down about it.
With all of that criticism flowing in, what happens? The White House put out another statement, didn't it, on Sunday?
Yeah, and it was kind of remarkable. What they decided to do in response to reporters was to put out a statement that condemned, in much more specific terms, the connections of protesters to the KKK, neo-Nazi movement, white supremacists. But they didn't put it out in the president's name. And by the way, this is a president who tweets things directly when he just wants to say them. He didn't do that. And it was attributed to an anonymous, quote-unquote, spokesperson.
And what does that tell
you? We did. Yeah, it just tells me that they're not, if you're looking to assert ownership and really say something forcefully, at the very least, you put someone's name behind it.
Finally, Glenn, in the meantime, one department within the Trump administration is kind of speaking out, interestingly, by saying that it's going to be opening a civil rights investigation into this car crash, which looked deliberate, like a deliberate killing of the counter-protesters by one of the white nationalists. What does that tell you? Does that tell you there's a little bit of dissent or conflict in the White House about how to handle this?
Well, it's sort of every man and woman for themselves in terms of articulating the way that they're going to deal with this. You know, Jeff Sessions, who is a child of South Central Alabama, in fact, during the campaign, I interviewed him and he spoke about, really candidly, by the way, of growing up in a segregated school district and seeing the black kids in a ratty old bus sort of passing him every day on the highway on the way to their substandard school. So, you know, so Jeff Sessions put out, I think, a very explicit statement talking about the origins of this violence in Charlottesville. And another thing is Ivanka Trump, shortly before this second statement came out on Sunday, also addressed it in more explicit terms. So it's very clear that while the president is continuing to be very reluctant to address this head on personally, the people around him are adapting to this and apparently have permission to say whatever the heck they want.
Thank you, Glenn. I really appreciate it.
Great talking to you.
On Sunday evening, Vice President Mike Pence condemned white supremacists, but also defended the president's own comments, saying Trump had, quote, clearly and unambiguously condemned what happened in Charlottesville. Here's what else you need to know today. Even as President Trump continues to threaten North Korea with military action, he is pressing its neighbor, China, to help de-escalate the situation by pressuring Kim Jong-un's regime to rein in development of nuclear missiles that can reach the United States. On Sunday, the president's national security advisor, H.R. McMaster, was asked if Trump's increasingly combative language towards North Korea meant that the U.S. was headed for a military conflict.
Let's move on now to North Korea. Are we closer to war now than we were a week ago?
No, I don't think so. And I think we're not closer to war than a week ago, but we are closer to war than we were a decade ago.
And the Times reports that Special Counsel Robert Mueller is in talks with the White House about interviewing current and former members of the Trump administration, including Reince Priebus, the recently fired chief of staff. Mueller has reportedly been asking about specific meetings, who was at them, and whether there is any documentation of them, and wants to ask the officials he speaks with about the president's decision to fire FBI Director James Comey in May. That's it for The Daily. I'm Michael Barbaro. See you tomorrow.